Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
It's one of the great houses of early Sydney, and you've seen it, sometimes without knowing, in the odd advert on television or in the magazines. But it's also a very significant part of Australian scientific history, for a number of reasons. Now Ashley Hay and Robin Stacey have produced a superb book to celebrate the mansion and the renowned museum which now houses its collection. The book is called simply Museum. Here to tell the story is writer Ashley Hay.
It's early in the morning, early in spring, in the last remaining patch of the acres of garden that once graced Sydney's Elizabeth Bay house. The sky is clear and high, and the deep blue of the harbour laps against the shore just down the hill. It's quiet, this pocket of space, and seems completely empty, the thick grass undisturbed, the trees still, the pond's water set like glass. Then a slash of orange and silver as a huge carp moves, its scales glinting in the sun, and suddenly there are dozens more fish, red and white, golden and black, illuminated as they turn below the surface with one flick of the tail. Two streaks of white overhead, a seagull first, quite small, and then a larger cockatoo cuts across the sky, its harsh call almost echoed by the two ibis that appear at the edge of the pond. From a little way off comes the repetitive sound of another bird, and a furry bee darts around, hovering and diving. Below the bee's flight stretches a gossamer web, some of its links frayed and battered. Another moment of stillness, and then the spider steps out from under a leaf, a dazzling thing moving slowly across the threads. Beyond, the harbour is striped with the wakes of boats, and the reach of land that forms the south head of Sydney's harbour tucks in front of the high cliff that forms the north. Another moment, and the birds fall quiet. Then a single butterfly passes, a dark flutter against the light in this garden that seemed 5 minutes ago as if it might hold nothing at all. Up the hill, behind creamy yellow walls, there's a room in Elizabeth Bay House that's furnished today as it might have been in the 19th century, when it accommodated three Maclay men, Alexander, his son William Sharp, and his nephew William John. Its shutters are drawn, the light that cuts between the slats only hinting at the bustle of Sydney that now presses up against the house itself. There are cabinets leaning against three of the room's four walls, tall, elegant wooden cupboards fitted with thin drawers. Some drawers are empty, the paper that lines them spotted with the perforations of thousands of pins that fixed thousands of insects to their boards. Others are full of butterflies and cicadas, bees and flies, packed in every which way, or neatly serried with labels fastened under their wings, their bodies, their feet. It's a fragment of a great collection that began with the unpacking of the first systematised specimens to come to Australia in 1826 and finished at the end of that century as the country's largest and most important assembly of specimens intended for teaching and instruction. Because it was from this house that the University of Sydney's Maclay Museum sprang, now one of the country's finest and sometimes forgotten historical collections. That collection held well over a million specimens when William John Maclay began to transfer it from his home to Sydney University in late 1888. It's now valued in excess of $42 million. And what's fascinating is that the contribution Elizabeth Bay made to this great assemblage was not just as a repository for all the accumulated birds and fish and skeletons and jars. Nor was it purely as the site of much 19th century scientific inquiry and busyness. The house and its grounds also gave up innumerable specimens for the collections, common creatures, rare creatures, and even those most important of taxonomic specimens, those type specimens studied and described when a species is first named. Which seems impressive as you stand in the pocket handkerchief of space that's all that's left of the original 54 acres of grounds, and hear the cars, the sirens, the people, the bustle of what is now as inner an inner city Sydney suburb as you can get. When Alexander Maclay became Colonial Secretary to New South Wales in 1826, he took the unprecedented step of bringing not only his wife and a brace of unmarried daughters with him from London, but also a collection of insect specimens, described as the finest and most extensive private collection then existing in the possession of a private individual. With a large family and a number of entomological cabinets, some men might have turned their attention to the immediate building of a house. But taking up land at Elizabeth Bay the year he arrived, Alexander instead began to make a garden, rich with jacarandas, poppies that had been named in his honour, and, less happily, camphor laurel and prickly pear. Sweet olive, avocado, mango and frangipani trees were sent to him from Calcutta, and other ships brought huon pines, blue gums and South African starfish lilies. The lawn alone was rumoured to have cost £3,000, and on it were held great picnics and dances and great conversations with passing scientific thinkers of the age, French, British, American. The officers of the HMS Beagle were entertained there during the ship's eminently famous Darwinian voyage, and years later Alexander's son, William Sharp Maclay, himself a distinguished natural historian, entertained such notable naturalists as Joseph Dalton Hooker, later director of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, and John Gould, researching what would become his Mammals of Australia. With Gould, W.S. Maclay stood and watched a bush turkey drown when it mistook its reflection for a rival. And with Gould, W.S. Maclay trapped and examined a number of supposedly indigenous Elizabeth Bay rats, the two men deciding that they constituted a new species, which they called Haplotis arboricola, although they later turned out to be the common garden variety rat, Rattus rattus, classified by Linnaeus almost a century earlier. But it was under the subsequent stewardship of William Sharp's cousin, William John Maclay, that the property's grounds were most keenly and extensively trawled for scientific specimens. Moving into the grand house on his cousin's death and taking custody of the family's already large natural history collections, W.J. Maclay determined to expand them to create one of the largest assemblies of Australian and exotic specimens ever amassed here. A great traffic of material flowed into the rooms of the graceful mansion, from collectors at home and abroad, from Sydney's shops and markets. Fishermen might arrive with two fish for Mr. Maclay, one to preserve in a vat of spirits, the other for breakfast. At chance meetings, even in Sydney's most salubrious clubs, friends presented him with anything from wallabies to worms, or once a clutch of geckos alive in a pickle bottle. Acquaintances in the medical world left him jars of parasites picked out of patients, and one young relative even arrived at the house with the body of her dead dog for a specimen. In the midst of which, the ever-curious William John began to harvest life in his own garden. Like his cousin and uncle before him, the possibilities of life around the harbour intrigued him. He put on his specially bought woolen socks, a pair of large shoes strapped on the upper for going into the water, and a pair of knee breeches for the same purpose, and spent days trawling his backyard shore and the other edges of Sydney Harbour, assembling material that was later described as both a systematic and successful attempt to obtain a representative collection of the marine fauna of Port Jackson. The house itself offered up new additions. His personal curator had caught about 20 bats in the cellar, Maclay reported one evening, and put them in a bottle of spirits. A butterfly net was purchased so the curator could trawl for jellyfish from the house's jetty. An extra long ladder was purchased after the curator's arms proved too short to access the many birds' nests in the garden for eggs to augment the ever-growing collection of birds being shot in the grounds. The garden yielded more than birds. An occasional domestic cat was caught and released, as were a multitude of less lucky local rodents and marsupials. In August 1874, for instance, any sensible bandicoot in the greater Elizabeth Bay area should have made tracks for a new home. Bandicoot after bandicoot was taken in rapid succession, including one Maclay described as so covered with ticks, small, large, and very large, and also with a large species of flea, it seems wonderful how he could have lived, yet he seemed well and lively. Past tense, of course. I intend, wrote William, to have him skinned. By 1875, the Maclay specimens had outgrown the house, and a purpose-built museum was erected in its grounds to accommodate both specimens and new workers. It was one of these later young workers who found a new richness of specimens concealed in a garden now more than 50 years old. Open any cabinet of insects, and it's the butterflies, the shimmering cicadas, the polished metal of beetles' bodies that catch your eye. These are not just pretty, they're conspicuously beautiful. But many other insects are so small that it's easier to distinguish variations in the lettering on their label's text than to distinguish their legs. Less likely to attract the attention of wandering naturalists are these flies and mosquitoes, these gnats and midges, the Diptera with their two wings. W.J. Maclay had talked about looking at Diptera, but what with everything else that came his way, it was something of a relief when Frederick Skuse, recently emigrated from England, arrived at Elizabeth Bay in 1888 with an interest in this kind of entomology. Maclay employed him, and it was soon reported that Skuse was making a very good beginning, filling in a previously blank space in our knowledge of the Australian fauna. Skuse began collecting and naming some of the country's smallest beasts, including Aedes nondescriptus, the mosquito most likely to bite you in Sydney, and Culex annulirostris, Australia's most important arbovirus vector that transmits the viruses responsible for Ross River fever and Murray Valley encephalitis, which is potentially fatal. And sometimes he hardly had to leave home to do his most exciting work. Because if Maclay had taken bats and bandicoots, birds and butterflies directly from his grounds to his cabinets, Skuse revealed a harbourside garden still busy with unseen, unknown things. He found an impressive 54 previously undescribed insect species among its vegetation in just a few years. All you had to do, he said, was look at your windows, especially if they overlook a garden or rural expanse. I have in this way obtained in one afternoon specimens of a score or more species. And the great advantage of this method was that insects which could otherwise be followed only with a remote chance of success, even by one possessing remarkably acute eyesight, are readily seen on a window and their capture is easily accomplished. When caught, he explained, they must be transferred to a pillbox and carefully placed between layers of soft, fresh leaves or petals of flowers so as to prevent shaking, while the moisture from the leaves will prevent them from becoming brittle and thus liable to get broken. Day after day, Skuse came in from the garden at Elizabeth Bay, his gnats and midges cradled in the softness of petals, one of the first people to understand the importance of knowing what these smallest of Australian things were and where. He was the last scientist to work this ground at Elizabeth Bay. By 1890, the Maclay family collection had moved to the University of Sydney, and Frederick Skuse had left the garden to work at the Australian Museum. Sydney has different memorials to the Maclay family and their passion, their obsession for natural history. You can still visit their museum at the university. You can see traces of their curiosity in the displays at Elizabeth Bay House. You'll probably come along Maclay Street in King's Cross to get there. You can acknowledge their role in the scientific world through 100-odd species names. Dozens of naturalists have attached the family suffixes Maclayi, Maclayii, Maclayanus and Maclayana to species from sea slugs and weevils to kingfishers, crabs, sponges, wallabies and the stringybark pine. It's a nice memorial, though, to stand on that little patch of remaining grass on a brisk city morning and remember how much of Australia's biodiversity was discovered or placed in the grand scheme of things from this now unlikely spot.
It's where I first saw the Cyclops, the one-eyed horse. That was Ashley Hay, who, with Robin Stacey, has produced one of the books of the year, Museum, it's called, published by Cambridge University Press. And that's where next week's manipulator of the Occam's razor once resided. Robin Derricourt talks about Raymond Dart. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.